welcome back to another episode of Candid, where we have real talks with real people. I'm here today with Shanae Forbes and Bethany McCarty, and we'll be speaking about recent events that have happened in the news.
So today we'll be starting with a case of alleged police brutality. There was a video circulating on social media where there was a young girl and her boyfriend at a party, I believe, and an altercation broke out. And a off-duty police officer allegedly assaulted the girl. And basically the story going around was that he thought that she was recording a fight between him and somebody else. And he basically locked her and her boyfriend up, but he called for backup and they were arrested. And apparently she was arrested and was going to be tried for assault. Now, I haven't seen any official reports on that yet. But if the social media is right in the way that the story goes, then that's pretty messed up. Because how can you be assaulted and then you are charged with assault just because it was a police officer? Especially if they weren't wearing their uniform, so you would not know. Yeah. And this is not the first incident of this in the country. Earlier this year, a man was awarded over $100,000 because he won his police brutality case. He was assaulted and he lost a few of his teeth. So, I mean, it seems as though it's a culture in this country. And I feel like a lot of times it kind of gets swept under the rug. So I don't know how we're going to change that.
Yeah. And I thought it was weird how they have this thing where you're basically guilty until proven innocent, which I don't think is fair. In most court systems, you're innocent until proven guilty, especially if there's no, I feel like, there should be a first court case in which they lay out the evidence before there's anyone charged in the matter, because it could ruin your life and it could take time away from you that wasn't warranted.
Well, I think one of the things that could assuage this kind of problem in the country is them actually using those body cams the public paid so much money for. Mm-hmm. So when they go to, you know, this first court that you're referring to, they could have at least a good much of evidence to base whether or not the case needs to, you know, further. What I'm saying is body cams should be, once you get on duty as an officer, body cams on, because incidents take place like suddenly. So they should always be on. We paid for them to be on. And if the body cam was on, because I think the story you're referring to is Treasure Torella and her boyfriend, the 19-year-old.
Yes.
The video that circled was approximately like 4 to 10 seconds long. So you can't really get a full essence of what was going on. But yeah, you do know that the police wasn't supposed to be doing what he was saying.
It was definitely excessive force, because he was a well-built man and she was a small, skinny female, and he wasn't holding her down. He was choking her, literally. And I feel like whether or not she started something, or I don't know what happened before or after, it still showed excessive force.
Definitely.
Well, what I would say is what happened before does matter. However, if those body cams were on, the public would get the full scope of what occurred. We do know that that police officer does need to be reprimanded for the actions he took during that incident. However, as someone who wants to know the full story, a body cam should have been on. Like, that is something that was necessary to give the full story as to what occurred. Because if they did assault officers before he used, which I will disclaim he should not have used, but if they were assaulting police officers, then you would understand why his hands are on her, probably in some self-defense, which I am still not condoning. However, you would get a complete story as to what happened, not just a police officer with his hands around a 19-year-old girl's neck.
I don't know if these reports are correct, because like I said, I haven't seen an official story from an official news outlet. I've only been seeing what's been circulated on social media. And it says that he was an off-duty police officer. So he wasn't in like in the police uniform.
Yeah, so the body cams wouldn't even be in effect.
And not even that. Even if they had assaulted this man, how would they possibly have known that he was a police officer? So I think it is unfair to then say, like we said, we don't know what happened. I think it's unfair to say, she shouldn't have assaulted a police officer. But like we said, we don't know what went down before that. But I feel like normally people feel like, if you assault a police officer, then you automatically go to jail. Like, but how are they to know that he was a police officer?
It's not, I don't even think it's about the situation on the whole. I think it's what I care more about is the way he handled it. As a police officer, she's not a police officer. She's not trained. He is. Mm-hmm. So if you're trained to do something in a profession, there should be guidelines on the way you treat people, whether or not they assault you first or not. Yeah. You should know how to treat someone. You shouldn't be choking someone. And we've seen issues where police officers choke others, especially in the United States, like the George Floyd case where he couldn't breathe and it became a race issue. Now imagine if that was a white cop, then we had a big issue over here and all of the news outlets would have been speaking about it. So I think it's overall that we need to work on our guidelines for police officers and the way they treat people.
I agree. I feel as though there should be some type of, I'm not well-versed on, but they have their training, but I feel like in terms of, you should be evaluating these people to make sure that they have the mental capacity to handle a job, because being a police officer is not easy. And if you could just snap just like that, I feel as though you shouldn't be in the job, because if you were dealing with a mental patient, so you told me you would have choked or you would have shot a mental patient. I mean, like, you should be well-versed on these type of issues. And I believe there was an incident similar to that recently, where there was a mental patient or whatever, and the police didn't really handle it in the best way. So it's something that we need to look at in this country for sure.
Another issue that I think needed to be looked at was that Wayne Monroe, Minister of National Security currently, he was speaking about the tracking devices that we were supposed to be using for individuals in quarantine. And he was saying that they were paying, under the FNM administration, they were paying $7,000 a month for these tracking devices that were not used. And he was saying so far we spent about $70,000, which I think it's crazy for things that and it may not seem like a lot of money, but we're billions of dollars in debt. I think $70,000 is a lot for something we're not using, for a technology that we're not using. And what he also was saying was that he didn't agree with the technology because it basically was just an app on someone's phone. And he was saying that I have 3 phones, so who's to say this person isn't leaving their phone at home? And even with my personal experience with being with someone who was in quarantine, no one really contacted us. And I feel that that's something we definitely need to look at as a country, the protocol for quarantine. And I think that the Davis administration has been looking into these issues, especially with curfew, but I think they definitely need to go a lot more in depth into quarantine measures. And he was speaking about, basically, I think it would be a wristband that you would put on people so that they're geotagged, so you know their actual location, and it's a lot more safe than an app on someone's phone. And there was a minister, the Minister of Health and Wellness, Dr. Michael Darvall, said that he was keen on using something like that.
So it would be similar to like an ankle bracelet.
Basically.
I don't know if I want to feel like a prisoner, though.
But
you're not a prisoner, but I feel like
It's when it comes to the welfare of the entire country, what is a wristband?
Yeah.
And it's a lot of people have not been taking COVID seriously. There have been a lot of people who have been in quarantine who decide, you know what, I'm going to go outside, I'm just going to go to the store, and they don't think anything of it. They may not have COVID, but someone they live in the house with has COVID. So, I mean, like, you don't necessarily sure if you have it or not, because you're supposed to be on for 14 days. So I feel like...
And technically, I wouldn't say you're a prisoner, but technically, you're under a lot more strict guidelines when you're in contact with someone with COVID and when you have COVID. So there are some of your freedoms are taken away from you, and that's just how life is now. It's the new normal. So whether or not you feel like a prisoner doesn't matter. I feel that it's not a wrist, it's not an ankle bracelet. I'm sure that it's a lot less official than that. Mm-hmm. But Yeah, I think it's something that does need to be implemented. And if it's not that, I think there should be some other way than an app on a phone or just the lackadaisical way that they've been treating it so far.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
I come on the angle of, okay, for instance, I live with more than one person. So I just come from the States and I am required by the law to put on this bracelet. I am home, but whatever I may have contracted from the States, I could share with my family members. Well, my family members also have to be required to stay home because
speaking of an individual who has COVID and they're not in quarantine. They're not making sure that person stays in quarantine for the 2 weeks that they're in quarantine. Now, I wasn't speaking about, you know, people around them. They should be calling the people who they've been in contact with to get tested. I'm speaking more specifically about those who actually tested positive for COVID and no one checks up on them. No one is ensuring that they stay in quarantine for those 2 weeks that they're supposed to be quarantined. They're supposed to have apps, but they don't use those apps or they don't check up on those individuals to ensure that they're staying home, not about visiting the United States and stuff like that.
But even Bethany, though, even if, for instance, I live in a house, I have three siblings. I live with my mom. I also have a friend that lives with me and her child. And I also have my stepdad. And if my mom was to contract COVID or my stepfather, everyone in the house would be required to quarantine. That's the protocol.
That's standard.
Yeah. So we may think that it's not fair, but how I look at it is, I don't want to risk anybody's life. So what is staying home for 2 weeks compared to how much people I could possibly infect if I just go outside, if I go to McDonald's and I give in money to the cashier, then the cashier goes home, infects her whole family, then her children go to school. It's just, I believe the number was one person can infect 200 and something people in one day. I believe that's what it was. That is a lot of people and that is a lot of lives that you're putting at risk. So what is it going to take for you to stay home? I mean,
especially if we're trying to build up tourism again, the way it was, we're blacklisted by a lot of countries because of the way that we're handling COVID and they feel that it's not sufficient enough. Mm-hmm. So if we really care about starting tourism up again, the way it used to be, quote unquote, then we should be taking this a lot more serious.
Yeah, I think we're level what, 3 or 4. Health is important. I don't think it's fair for me to endanger anyone's life. You know, being on death's door is not fun. And I wouldn't ever want to knowingly put someone else in that situation. So I feel like people need to take quarantine more seriously.
Or they could even have a distinction where the person who actually tested positive would have a different color wristband than someone who was in contact with them. And maybe the person who was in contact with them would get tested a week later instead of having the entire 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's also an option. It's ways to work through it, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, Bethany, I believe under the former administration, they were putting people who tested positive in breezers and people were complaining. So if you had tested positive, then you could have went to breezers and your family could have carried on with their life. But some people didn't like that idea. So it's just something we have to deal with, I assume.
Okay. So when I said, when I did my scenario, I'm not referring to people who have tested positive, because if you test positive, you can't re-enter the country. If you were in the States, you can't re-enter the country until you test negative. Because my friend, when she was in the States, she went through that whole debacle and I kind of witnessed that with her. However, I do agree that if somebody does have COVID, if they do test positive for COVID, that they should be reprimanded to stay, to be, you know, quarantined for the 2 weeks. But the thing is with me, I'm referring to persons who have traveled, had a negative test. Whilst, if you think about it, you have to take the test, I think it's 3 days. Within 3 days. However, someone could easily contract the virus on the last day, on the third, if they took the test 3 days prior. The day before they come back to the Bahamas, they could be positive. How do we know? But I do know when I came back into the country, I had to get tested again. So I think that was a great way to put that the Menace administration kind of tried to decrease or keep an eye on those persons traveling to and from the Bahamas to different countries. So I thought that was a great way to make sure that, you know, everybody was staying safe and being each other's keepers in a way.
Well, actually, the Menace administration, they had their whole vaccination day debacle, and they said that once you're vaccinated, this was in, I believe, May of 2020, they said once you're vaccinated, you do not have to have a negative COVID test. And then later on, after Bahamians were making noise and saying that that didn't make any sense, and obviously, I guess, from when they talked to their to the doctors and stuff, that that's when they re-implemented that even vaccinated people had to be tested.
Yeah.
So they didn't start off with that. They did not start off with that because their whole, I feel like that was a whole ploy for them to get people to be vaccinated.
Also recently there was Adrian Gibson had actually, so 2 months after the information was leaked on Adrian Gibson, who admitted to, he hadn't actually admitted yet, but there were allegations against him for awarding contracts to his fiance at the time without following the correct procedures to make it known that they were personal together, like they knew each other, because I think that's something that we're supposed to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was a recent article by The Guardian where he admitted to knowing the person. He said, the corporation awarded me a memo to a company whose principals engaged an attorney, yes, who is known to me to provide corporate services. He spoke about the legality of it. And he also said that, Gibson said that Water and Sewage Corporation's policies do not restrict the discretion of vendors to choose anyone they wish to carry out their affairs. And added that it is not unusual for attorneys to act on the behalf of their clients. Basically saying that he didn't have to make it clear that he was personal with that, with the lawyer that he awarded the contracts to. Now, in another article from September, they were speaking about the amounts that were awarded to these people, and they were both about $200,000, which was a lot, I believe, for cleaning, essentially, was what they were contracted for, cleaning and painting 13 of the water and sewage's properties. What's your thoughts on that?
When did this come out?
This came out in August, late August, early September, but he just now acknowledged it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And he acknowledged it recently. So all of these months, because I remember seeing this, I don't know if I should call it a scandal, but I remember seeing this article that was talking about this right before the elections. And I remember the former prime minister saying that he supported Adrian Gibson and all of that.
He said he supported Adrian Gibson with his efforts, with his constituents,
mm-hmm.
But he didn't acknowledge the whole quote-unquote scandal.
Yeah, and I think that's very interesting.
Especially for a government that
valued themselves on transparency.
Yes.
Yeah. And I feel like he should have addressed this a long time ago, because it kind of looks bad on your part to not talk about something like this when you're in a public sphere, and what you did kind of directly affects the Bahamians, because these are our dollars.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. So I just feel like he should have addressed it sooner. I mean, I'm glad that he addressed it, but
I think it wasn't the amount of money that was allocated to these issues. It was more that he didn't do it in the correct way, because he's saying that Water and Sewage doesn't have any things in place, policies in place that you have to tell that you're connected to this individual, but aren't there policies in place under the government that you have to make it known, yes, that mm-hmm. you're connected to that individual. And they in the Guardian's article in September, they actually went in depth about who was connected to the Water and Sewage and to the corporation, I think it's called Elite Cleaning or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they were basically like saying like he was connected to the individuals who were connected to this company. So it seemed odd that it wasn't just like his fiance, it was several people that he was connected to. And it seemed a bit sticky.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, hand in hand, like I know this person, so you take it. But he was saying that that's not the case. They were well prepared for that.
I think Adrian's response is kind of a bit too late. I think he was more so forced by the media to respond after they had published what had happened during that particular incident. So for me, this kind of mirrors the same thing that occurred during the Christie's administration, seeing how much corruption was going on under his leadership. While he may or may not have been, you know, kind of engaged in all of that, he was the leader. And so that kind of showed on his part for Minnis and this whole situation to occur. It kind of speaks, just like it did for Christie, it speaks on Minnis's leadership. And that's probably another reason why, you know, the recent F&M, you know, their kind of disgust and they're in turmoil as a party. And so for me, this incident reflects on what happened during the Christie's administration. And now for me, it really isn't surprising the turnouts that occurred during the F&M's snap election, you know, because when you find out that all of this kind of dark politics is going on behind the scenes, it always speaks to the leaders, his stance, his leadership to guide his party in the right direction. It speaks a lot on the transparency that they claimed the party had, and they still stand on their transparency initiative even now. So when it came to the deficit that the Honorable Brave Davis said inside Parliament, they still stand on the premise that the F&M government was transparent in all of their dealings with the Bahamian purse.
Yeah. Well, for me, it wasn't really about the corruption, because corruption happens in every country under every administration, under every president, prime minister, whatever. But I think that I didn't really appreciate the way it was handled, especially given given the way Minnis had handled the situation with Dr. Dwayne Sands. It wasn't the same type of situation, but it was information that was leaked. And it was information that was leaked after the fact of what had happened. And Minnis did not stand for Dr. Dwayne Sands, but he stood for Adrian Gibson. So it seemed a bit off the way he had responded to both situations. It seems a bit more like curry favor than anything.
Probably why there's so much division inside that party. Because mm-hmm. as you saw during the election, when they were out there doing their rallies, we saw Ingram backing up Dwayne Sands, the same person, Minnis. You know, it seemed like he was such a disposable minister to Minnis, because you know, he just accepted his resume without any questions. But here we see Adrian Gibson doing all of this foolishness. And even with all the information given to the public, Minnis still says, well, he's going to back him up. So it's the favoritism is definitely seen, especially here in this incident.
Yeah, and also Dr. Dwayne Sands, he spoke out a lot about the inconsistencies of the F&M administration. And I think maybe that had a part to play in what had happened and how the Dr. Minnis handled the situation with him, you know, bringing in the COVID swabs or whatever. So I think that played a big role. But moving on, so obviously we knew even prior to the election that the emergency orders were going to end in November. So they're supposed to be ending on November 13th. And the Minister of Health and Wellness, Dr. Michael Darbo, he said that there will be no curfew, but the rules are fluid, meaning that if they feel that the cases are rising and that curfew would be the best option again, that they probably would re-implement it. But he says that he hopes that that is not in the near future. And they also said that many of the protocols, such as mask wearing, sanitizing, and social distancing, will still remain in place. And some other protocols are indoor dining will be allowed at 50% capacity, but individuals must be vaccinated or have a negative COVID test. Also, 20 people can be at a private social gathering indoors, but must be vaccinated. Outdoor event attendees must be vaccinated or have a negative COVID test. Church services, weddings, and funerals can be held indoors. However, New Providence, Inagua, Acklands, Eleuthera, the Berry Islands, and the Crooked Islands, they can only operate in a church in the church for churches, weddings, and funerals at 33% seating capacity. Now, I feel that this is something similar to what the former administration was doing, because even if you're vaccinated or not, you still can carry the virus. So I think it's kind of unfair to say that if you're vaccinated that you don't need a COVID test. Especially since this current administration says that they're trying to provide free testing. So I feel as though vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals should have negative COVID tests to dine inside or to have social gatherings and stuff. And also, I am very curious about how they are going to monitor these private social gatherings and outdoor gatherings as well. So are you going to just walk up to people and be like, where's your negative COVID test on a vaccination card? Like, how are you going to monitor that? So I feel like it should be the same shit across the board for everybody, whether vaccinated or unvaccinated, seeing that the entire population isn't fully vaccinated as yet, or most of us are not vaccinated as yet. So I feel like that it should remain the same shit across the board, regardless if you're vaccinated or not.
I agree. Go ahead.
I'm because I have literally witnessed, I'm not going to call the restaurant's name, but I did go and I made this reservation to this particular restaurant, and they had asked if I was vaccinated or not. I stated that I was vaccinated. I had to show no proof of my vaccination, and mm-hmm. they just let me sit inside. And I'm like, I looked at my friends, and I'm like, she did not ask us where our identifications was, nothing of the sort. It was just, yes, I'm vaccinated, and that's it. So I think the government will put in place a lot of heavy fines on private institutions about that.
I think they will, because I understand the leeway that we're given for fines in terms of COVID restrictions, because a lot of people have lost their jobs and a lot of businesses have had to lay off a lot of people and they've had to cut finances. So I don't necessarily agree with the sense of fining people, but it should definitely be enforced and policed to ensure that you're showing your vaccination card, if that's the protocols that we're going to be under.
I also have a story. So I know someone who went to, like you said, a restaurant, and obviously you're required to either be vaccinated or to be tested. So this person forgot to take a COVID test, right? But they had a photo of a vaccination card that was not theirs. So they showed the vaccination card and the lady didn't ask for any ID to prove, because some of them don't have your photo on it. She didn't ask for any identification to prove that this was you. She didn't look at the date or anything, date of birth to confirm. Like, it was just like, okay, you flashed this card for 3 seconds and it's free to go. So it's just like, what is the point of these restrictions? It's not clicking. Like, it's not clicking for me. And these institutions are not, I don't want to say they're not taking it seriously, but it's just like, if you're going to ask me for a vaccination card or for a PCR test, I expect you to inspect that.
And with that being said, we're not anti-vax.
No, we're not.
I agree with vaccinations, okay? We would just like to see more long-term data, and we don't like to be forced into anything. The fact that we don't get to see the negatives of vaccinations, it's always positive, 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 and then the other stories are hidden. And that is what makes me a bit wary of it.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And it's like, they're not, nobody is saying, oh, you, like, nobody's being overt, oh, you must be vaccinated. Like, for instance, to get into the United States, you have to be vaccinated. No, the Bahamas hasn't taken that stance. We're saying that it's your choice. However, you're saying that it's my choice, but you're taking away my liberties as a citizen. You're telling me I can't.
Dine in.
Well, the Davis administration changed this, but under the former administration, you couldn't dine inside if you were not vaccinated. You could not do certain things if you were not vaccinated. I mean, granted, this administration has now said that if you're unvaccinated and you provide a COVID test, but I also feel that, like I said, vaccinated individuals should have a COVID test because people have the assumption that because you're vaccinated, you're invincible and you cannot spread COVID, and that's not what it's for. The vaccine is to lessen your chance of getting severe symptoms of COVID. But a lot of people don't understand that. A lot of people feel like, you know, once I'm vaccinated, that's it, that's all. And I could go and do whatever I want
to
do.
And things will go back to normal. And there's no normal anymore. There's a new normal, and it's not going to be like the old normal.
I don't see that happening for a while. I don't see it happening for a while.
But in an ideal world, the protocols that the Brave Davis administration set in place, it would be ideal, you know, but in a realistic world, certain measures still need to be in place because, yes, we want of course, we're not going to get our normal back. However, we want it back as close as possible. We want something similar, not the same, but very similar. And so restrictions still have to be in place. We know, at least right now, the data says that, you know, once you're vaxxed, you still can get the virus and you can still pass it on. So with that information, we need to start basing our restrictions and our laws off of current studies. So that's all I would have to say on that. Like with the Minnis administration, the Bahamas had to go through several stages just to see what fits. But now we have enough data to kind of make wise decisions on behalf of our country to make sure we save as much lives as possible.
And we're definitely not getting on one administration than the other. We're just likening the two different protocols that they put in place.
Yeah, comparing and contrasting.
Yeah. Now, and a thing that I think that the Brave administration has done that I really, really do agree with was their stance on climate change. Recently, they attended the 26th United Nations Climate Change Conference of the Parties, or COP26, in Glasgow. Now, whether or not you believe on climate change or even care about it, I feel that our attendance was a positive catalyst for our relationships with the United Nations and the countries that attended it. I also think that it was a step in the right direction for the Brave administration in connecting with Bahamians that are interested in climate change, especially the younger generation who really, I feel that we think about it a lot. But what I really appreciated was the way the speech was delivered and how well written it was. And it boded well for the country. It's a good impression for us on other countries. I feel that he delivered it very well, and I encourage others to listen to it. He spoke about the trauma of Hurricane Dorian and how basically it related to climate change, and how if we don't really focus on the matter, hurricanes will get worse and worse for us, especially for a country that experiences hurricanes. We should be focusing on ways to combat hurricane issues and the worsening of hurricanes if climate change is a real thing. And I think that's, I really appreciated that.
Doc? Yeah, I loved how he incorporated the beauty and the resilience of the Bahamas, because what the beginning and the end of his speech, he referred to the Olympians, our Olympians, and the resilience we have and the dedication and the drive to better ourselves and to help better the world. And then he incorporated, you know, the suffering And that was so, the way he delivered it was so passionate and so thoughtful, because a lot of times we forget what happened as a country. We forget that Dorian happened to those people in Abaco and Freeport. We really do forget the impact it had on those people. And for him to bring that up, well, of course he had to bring it up because it's talking about the environment and climate, but for him to not forget about those people who endured that devastating hurricane, it was such a brilliant idea. I don't know who wrote that speech. If he did, I give him applause. But that was powerful. And I feel like for everyone who listened to him speak, they were touched. And they could feel the energy, the suffering, everything that occurred during that hurricane, during in those islands. Because when I was literally shocked to my bones when after that speech. I do believe in whoever is representing our country, I want the best for them. And I believe at that moment, he definitely did his best for our country.
Yes, I was very proud. And I feel that that's why I encourage others to listen to it, because it wasn't just for building relationships with the UN. I feel that that builds his relationship with Abaconians and Grand Bahamians, because he showed the importance of what happened to them and that it wasn't forgotten, and his efforts in avoiding such an incident happening again. Like, obviously he can't control hurricanes, but he can control the way we combat those issues. And I think that was genius on whoever wrote the speech, and I think it was genius for him the way he delivered it. It was very heartfelt.
I think another thing that I admired was his determination to actually start getting people to put actions into their words, because he did state that every time the conference occurs, there's talks, there's agreements, there's acts that take place, and those things are written up, but nothing is ever done. And he urged people on behalf of Bahamians to start doing and stop talking. That is something that I really took from that. Well, it was one of the things that I took from his speech. Start doing and stop talking, because every time the Bahamas is represented there, yes, we speak as to what's going on here. We get a couple people to say, well, we'll do this and we'll do that, but we never feel it as a country. We never see it come into fruition. So for him to plead with those people causing all of this destruction, this natural destruction to occur in our country, well, I wouldn't say the majority of time they cause it. They do the most damage to the environment. So yeah, they cause it. But to start and build a deeper relationship where they can actually come and start to do and start to contribute to what they're causing. And I think several times he referred to us as his people, you know, and it kind of built this unity, this united front as a country to actually get something started to save ourselves, because we can't, although we're illustrious, you know, beautiful, intelligent group of people, we're limited to what we can do because of what they are doing. It was a beautiful speech. But the way he related, I think that gave the punch it needed to give. It was given.
Yeah, and speaking on change, right? Minister QC Wayne-Monroe said that they planned to change the prison policy. So basically, currently, if you're sentenced to, for instance, 10 years in prison, which is 120 months, you only serve 80 months because you get 4 months off for good behavior. But he says that the government's plan is to allow people to serve their full sentences. And when the policy is enacted, for instance, okay, all of it may not be spent in prison. So for instance, if you get out on parole, but if you mess up, then you go back to prison and you serve the rest of your sentence, which never happened before. And I assume that's why so many people would get out early and they would just be doing a bunch of foolishness. So he said that they intend to change this. And he also talked about short sentences, and he's saying that short sentences don't really allow for the rehabilitation of prisoners. What it does is it just destroys lives. So for instance, if you go to prison for 3, 4, 5, even 6 months, right? You are gonna lose your job, gonna lose your home, you may lose your family. And no real rehabilitation could take place in just 6 months. So you're coming out of prison to go back to nothing. So the only thing you could do is to return to a life of crime. He didn't specifically say what they plan to do to mitigate that, but he did say that is something that they're currently working on.
I think 4 months is a lot to take off of someone's sentence per year. I think if you're serving 5 years, then getting out 6 months to a year early is different from taking 4 months per year off of a 10 to 20 year sentence. That seems like a lot. That adds up. I don't understand how that was even enacted in the first place. But I'm glad that he's taking steps in mitigating the issues with the corrections system, especially given the recent story that came out. Were you going to speak about that?
With the young man who died in the prison?
Yes.
Yeah. So a 28-year-old man who's currently in and out of Sandlands, and he also had, his mother said that he had mental illnesses, and what had happened was that he had stolen some items from his mother. I believe it was a cell phone and it was a tablet, and she'd called police to help her to get him rehabilitated into Sandlands, but that didn't happen. They arrested him and they took him to the jail. And she went to the police station and she was pleading for them to send him to Sandlands instead of back to prison. And he was in the courtroom and he was begging that they don't send him to prison or whatever. And apparently he died. And there hasn't been any official statements released on that. Minister of National Security QC Raymond Rose said that the doctor could have only given what he had seen, but they will have official autopsy reports that will determine whether he died of natural causes or homicide, and then they will go from there and investigate the matter.
I think that prison is it's a difficult place. We all know that, especially being in prison. The living conditions, as we've seen, are deplorable. And I think for someone with a mental issue, it's strenuous. It could even cause more mental issues. And I don't know in which way that he died, but I'm quite sure his treatment in prison did not align with the way he should have been treated, given his mental illnesses. And I don't understand how he ended up in prison in the first place. Now, you're saying that his mother actually, she sent him there on purpose because she wanted not for him to go to prison, but for him to get the help that he needed because he refused to take his medication. Mm-hmm. And that shows a flaw in the system where, like, as soon as they said that he was a mental patient, he should have been sent straight to Sandlands Rehabilitation Center by the police as an escort. I understand why she called the police, because she's a woman and he needs help, and she probably didn't have the strength to take him back to Sandlands. Yeah. And they didn't do what needed to be done. And that again shows a lacking by the police in a situation that could have been easily handled.
Unavoided.
Yes. And I think that's very sad. And if you listen to the interview, it was heartbreaking the way she was speaking about it. And she was even saying that it was a while before she was even notified of what had happened. And it's heartbreaking to hear those type of stories. And I feel like the whole moral of this whole episode that we're doing right now is we need to focus on the little things, because the little things create big issues. Mm-hmm. A tiny crack become a big hole. Mm-hmm. And I hope that the Davis administration does that, especially given his experience in legal issues and being a lawyer. I hope that he focuses on this. And I hope that QC Wayne Monroe also focuses on these issues that are coming about. It seems that he's focusing on a lot, and I appreciate that. Definitely.
Yeah, because he's always been an advocate for the people. Like, for instance, when we were on lockdown in 2020 and the people were protesting, and he said that, and they were locked, some of them were locked up, and he went and he was like, I'm going to represent these people. And so I think that him being the Minister of National Security is going to be great. I think he's going to do great things, and I hope that he lives up to that expectation.
A lot has been coming out with the newest ministers, especially Joe Beth Colby Davis. and Wayne Monroe. And we see them pushing and administrating for different issues. And hopefully they will continue these fights, because a lot of times we see administrations come in and they work vigorously in the first year or two, and maybe even the last year or two. And in the middle, we don't see any efforts or changes. And I hope that's not the same thing now.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I would say, referring to the incident with the gentleman who died in prison, that's something that we need to take into consideration as a country, this same particular story, because mental health is so important. And in the Bahamas, I don't think we see it as significant as it is. But like you were saying, this new administration, I loved how they implemented Ministry of Health and Wellness. I think that last part, and wellness, speaks great volume as to the change I'm hoping that they continue to make for our country. I know the Minister of Health, Michael Darvel, he's been doing a lot in the health department. And so that's something that I hope what kind of flourish we could get rid of the social ills that occur in our country, because in no world should that man have been put in jail because of a mental illness he was going through. Because a lot of times we kind of push aside those people dealing with mental illness, and that's something that's real and it's prevalent. Although we may not know it, it's prevalent in this country. And so for stories like that not to persist, this administration needs to stick to their plan for the wellness of this country, mentally, physically, and spiritually, so we could care for each other the best way possible.
Definitely.
Yeah, and also I find it very interesting because they changed the prison's name from Her Majesty's Prison, right? And they turned it into the Bahamas Correctional Facility. And the whole point of correction is to help rehabilitate these people. And it doesn't, I may be wrong, but it doesn't seem as though anybody's being rehabilitated. It looks like the same old system that's been happening is still happening, and that they just changed the name. And I hope under the new administration, seeing that they're taking strides to correct these sentences, hopefully they could help correct some of the conditions of the prison, and hopefully get some of these people just like real help, you know, because in like you guys said, there's no way that man should have been sent there. And I'm hoping that he wasn't murdered or beaten. I'm hoping that didn't happen, and you know, maybe something just went wrong.
Well, that was our last story. So thank you for tuning in to another episode of Candid, where we have real talks with real people. Thank you to Bethany McCarty and Shanae Forbes. My name is Anise Bell, and we'll see you next week.
So you can follow us on social media on Instagram and Facebook at Candid242. Keep it real, Bahamas.